every president who's been elected since 2008 has been elected to rein in the military-industrial complex and has been defeated by the military-industrial complex. That's certainly a sign of declining democracy. But these guys see that as a virtue. They see that as the way the world should be. People like Robert Gates.
To understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest.
The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
Rob, are you ever worried America doesn't have enough nukes?
Super worried, Rory. Like, it really bugs me. Just like, I feel like if we had more nukes,
you'd have less homelessness
and more aircraft carriers. You know, aircraft carriers, those military platforms that cost obscene amounts of money and haven't been tested in war in 80 years. We should have more of those too. We need anything that's really, really expensive and doesn't actually provide that many jobs. We should do more of that, because what's important, Rory, is not security. It's not even jobs or congressional votes. What's important is building mansions in Bethesda.
Those contractors need to be paid.
Yeah, the Washington, D.C. suburbs need more mansions. And honestly, there's probably only like 25 sushi places in Istanbul, in Washington, D.C. now.
Let's get a couple in Istanbul while we're at it.
yeah, why not, right? I mean, there's military contractor. They make Bayraktars there. You know, the Turks are in NATO. They've got their own military industrial complex that's profited off of the decades of war that people like Robert Gates have helped to build. And so
would you like to crack into paragraph three?
Paragraph three. Well, we should just in the unlikely event that you've someone has discovered this without listening to the last episode, we are talking about Robert Gates, possibly the most influential.
I think he's the bizarro version of Robert Morris. What do you think?
It's entirely possible. Probably one of the most respected and influential people in U.S. foreign policy. I am certainly at the opposite end of that. He has gifted us an intervention in Foreign Affairs magazine entitled The Dysfunctional Superpower. And we've talked a great deal in the last episode about the significance of Mr. Gates, the Foreign Affairs magazine, why we've decided to do a detailed deconstruction of this article. We only made it to paragraph two in the last episode, and this is definitely the second and last episode that we're going to dedicate to Mr. Robert Gates and his article, but we've got a lot to go through.
Before you start, I just want to know, what's the main difference with Robert Gates to Robert Kagan? Because to me, they have a lot of overlap.
Well, Robert Gates is a practitioner. Robert Gates is, I would say, like, despite how angry I am at what Robert Gates has written here, he is a figure that I respect. I mean, he was in the CIA for decades. He helped wind down the Cold War. As ludicrous as both the Iraq surge and the Afghanistan surge proved to be, he did pick up the pieces of just basic respect for U.S. government and the U.S. military after the abomination that was George W. Bush and his clowns. He's actually someone who does things. He's the president of universities, this and the other thing. Robert Kagan was in government very briefly. My understanding is that he participated in the rape of Central America in the 1980s. And he's mostly just sort of sat around and farted out think pieces for the decades since. And because he's literate enough to sound sensible and principle-free enough to always be doing the bidding of military contractors, Robert Kagan has had a career of great length and zero merit. Robert Gates has actually done things. So, you know, despite the disintegration of this article that we're going to participate in for the next hour, I mean, Robert Gates is a real person. Robert Kagan, who we did a debunking of a while back, is just sort of catering to power.
So he would cater to what Gates wants to hear?
I would say so. Yeah. Unfortunately, probably. I mean, I doubt Robert Gates, if he's aware of him, has much respect for Robert Kagan, but certainly sees. So people like Robert Kagan craft arguments for people like Robert Gates to use. I think that's probably a good distinction, if that makes sense. You know, he would say, Robert Gates would see Robert Kagan as a intermittently useful employee,
I suppose would be the relationship between those two men if they have one.
What's Xi Jinping done now?
Well, Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin have much in common, but two shared convictions stand out. First, each is convinced that his personal destiny is to restore the glory days of his country's imperial past. You see, this is true, I think, to an extent. I don't think I need to read the whole paragraph here. What is underappreciated, and as we sort of closed the last episode with me sort of venting about, is the extent to which Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping are in power and are as influential as they are within their countries because of U.S. aggression. Yes, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin are obsessed with very bloody-minded ideas of imperial power because the United States has crushed them into that world over the past 20 years. Vladimir Putin, spent the 2000s at least, up until 2008, trying desperately to find a way to fit in to the U.S. world order, and was still working on that, honestly, until 2022. Obviously, he sort of fell, in 2008, he invaded Georgia and fell away out of that. And then in 2014, with the invasion of Ukraine, it was, that was sort of a forlorn hope, but there was still negotiation going on. And Putin is a negotiator. Yes, now he's trying desperately to preserve what little pretensions towards any kind of power that he has. I think this article actually includes the Brzezinski quote that Russia is essentially nothing without Ukraine. Putin thought that he'd be able to maintain influence in Ukraine the way that the United States maintains influence in Mexico, and tried to do that for the first 14 years he was in power, until in 2014 the United States sponsored the violent overthrow of a democratically elected pro-Russian president in Ukraine.
But do you think there's no want to be more American, more European focused in Ukraine? Is it all, is it all a coup?
No, there was very much legitimate, and there was no reason they couldn't do both. Ruri, there's been a ton of, within the regime of Vladimir Putin and Russian government, there's been a ton of it. And really, the way to understand Vladimir Putin and the oligarchs, a fundamental aspect of their character, is desperately trying to be American, desperately trying to be part of the West and part and American. And like they devolved into, yes, like a mafia state in some respects because they were trying so hard to be American.
To laissez-faire.
Yes, that I think. I don't think we have the time to get into shock therapy and all that. But there were many mistakes made. But yeah, no question that Ukraine was Western focused. But goddammit, Russia was Western focused for the first decade of Putin's time in power. Like Putin tried desperately to find a way to work with the United States and the broader world, and he couldn't do it because the United States didn't let him. So now he's in this sort of sad, desperate, like, I'm going to scramble around and murder hundreds of thousands of people to try and preserve an independent Russia. He's failing at it. And it's quite sad. But it's just like, this paragraph and a lot of the discussion in here, can't read every paragraph. A lot of the discussion in here is just talking about China and Russia as if they emerged in the 2010s or even the 2020s as these crazy aggressive meanies with no consideration of what the United States did to make them that way. Second, both leaders are convinced that the developed democracies, all above all the United States, are past their prime and have entered an irreversible decline. This decline, they believe, is evident in these democracies' growing isolationism, political polarization, and domestic disarray. Two things about this, the growing isolation, political polarization, and domestic disarray of the democracies. First off, this is something that foreign affairs and the U.S. foreign policy establishment spends a lot of time selling this idea that democracy is falling apart, authoritarianism's on the rise, U.S. democracy is falling apart, blah, 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 blah. I don't really think U.S. democracy is falling apart. I think Donald Trump was a horrific president.
But the fact that he was elected in part because he was like one of the only people who had the courage to say that, oh, wait, the military-industrial complex is ripping us off. It's a massive fraud. Like, it's actually a sign that there's actually a lot of democracy left in the United States.
What would be signs that there was less democracy in America, in your opinion?
Well, the fact that every president who's been elected since 2008 has been elected to rein in the military-industrial complex and has been defeated by the military-industrial complex, that's certainly a sign of declining democracy. But these guys see that as a virtue. They see that as the way the world should be. People like Robert Gates. I haven't read it, but I've got the newest issue of Atlantic Monthly has Mark Milley on the cover. This is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who in domestic politics was a pretty gross Republican. He distinguished himself during Trump's attempt to crush riots in Washington, D.C. by marching in uniform with Trump through Washington, D.C., an incredible violation of all civ-mil borders, like just disgusting. I think he should have resigned the second that happened. But he's been lionized on the cover of the Atlantic Monthly. Joint Chiefs of Staff have like 5-year terms intentionally staggered from presidents. He's finally retiring now. And he's been, the Atlantic Monthly put him on the cover as a hero because he stood up to what the elected president of the United States wanted to do.
Yeah, that is worrying.
So yeah, the Atlantic Monthly on its cover this month is celebrating Mark Milley, a U.S. general, for ignoring the democratically elected commander-in-chief. Donald Trump wanted to do some really gross things with the military, but he also tried to get out of Syria 3 times. He announced the withdrawal from Syria 3 times. We've still got U.S. troops there, and if there's a war between the United States and Iran, it'll be very likely because those troops are sitting ducks and should have been taken out every time Trump wanted them taken out. But if Iran decides to escalate, they'll be there to be murdered. These guys are the U.S. military industrial complex, Robert Gates, the foreign policy establishment, foreign affairs, the Atlantic Monthly. These guys are the corruption of democracy. And of course, they're so powerful that, like, you know,
when you hear a lot of these conspiracy ones talking about the deep state, is this a very obvious, you know, not to go too conspiratorial, but this is kind of what they're generally talking about, is the military industrial complex controlling so much of the media and basically saying, no, Donald Trump's wrong there. We've got to go do this.
Well, the thing is that everybody likes to put their partisan spin on it. So I think deep state is now a little more Republican coded. So Sean Hannity is like, oh, well, it's Hillary Clinton controls everything, which is utter nonsense. But no, deep state. And then I think Obama's foreign policy guy, Ben Rhodes, who was sort of, I think he was a speechwriter. And I mean, it's actually kind of a testament to how desperately alone Barack Obama was, that this guy, Ben Rhodes, who was a speechwriter, who just had, seems like he read a couple books on the Middle East.
Yeah.
And he became Obama's absolute go-to guy on foreign policy because he was relatively uncorrupted by the foreign policy establishment. Most people who sit with a president and give him foreign policy ideas have spent a decade utterly incorporating everything that Robert Gates is saying here. Whether it's through their universities or just living in Washington, D.C. and understanding like what you're supposed to believe and what you're supposed to know and what you're supposed to say. So Ben Rhodes, this speechwriter who just, you know, had some decent foreign policy ideas and managed to become one of the most powerful foreign policy figures by the end of the Obama administration, key part of like JCPOA, opening Cuba, all that stuff. He's come up with a term that means the same thing that Republicans talk about when they talk about the deep state, and it's the blob. The foreign policy blob, which is actually, I think, kind of a more evocative. You think deep state and you think of like Turkish like security services with mobsters and like killing stuff. But the blob is like more like, and it's this mess of people who get published in foreign affairs, work at universities, work in media, and all just sort of pull in the same direction. Pretty much the Republican and Democratic parties are entirely are just entirely controlled by the blob.
the vast majority of what they say or what they think about. There's very little dissidence from it in either political party.
Is there any way to get away from the blob, or is it too late at this stage?
I mean, I think that what's necessary, well, you'd say, like, well, the blob has to lose. The blue blob constantly loses. It's been two decades of horror, destruction, and failure. But it hasn't been horror, destruction, or failure that it's impacted the United States much. It's interesting because you're talking about how, you know, there is, I think, real decline and disarray in the European Union because of the refugee crisis that the United States created under the Bush and Obama administrations. Obviously, there's a lot of other problems. You know, the euro wasn't done so well. The, you know, Germans probably aren't that helpful. There's many reasons. You know, the Greeks probably shouldn't have made up their deficit. Like, there's many, many internal reasons. But, like, the fundamental, like, driver of the right-wing resurgence and the sort of atomization of the European Union, including Brexit, was the refugee crisis created by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan under Bush, and then the destruction of Syria and Libya by Obama. And yeah, like, it's just like, again, like, this throughout this, it's just like the past 20 years didn't happen. The past 20 years of world destruction didn't happen. Give the people who destroyed the world more money. That's what this Gates article is about.
So basically, they can destroy all this stuff, but they don't have to deal with the consequences. You know, America or the blob can create all these problems, and then they don't have to worry about the ramifications. They're not the countries that are getting bombed or the ones that are getting fled to that, you know, have knock-on effects. They just go back to their, you know, fancy sushi restaurants in Washington, D.C. and complain that they're not getting, you know, $200,000 a year.
Yep. And that's what, and I think it was in the aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine where I was just like, and they won. Like, I don't, I do think eventually, I mean, all empires fall. I think that eventually there will be such, and because of nuclear weapons, we are in a position where the chances of it all ending in an instant are much higher. But without that horrific likelihood, which becomes probably a near certainty by the end of this century, I think we're just going to keep limping along with the world getting worse and the United States being like, that's terrible, for the rest of our lives.
It's just reminded me of something. I remember it was a high ranking, general was talking about basically one of the main threats to America is climate change, but like, you don't see many generals talking about that in the news for some reason.
Well, and the incredibly messed up thing, Rory, is that we're also much better position to deal with climate change than anybody else.
You're not Bangladesh, you know? That's for sure.
Yeah, we've got the Great Lakes, you know, we've got fresh water for days, and honestly, there's been some great science fiction written about how Arizona's going to have to empty out, but honestly, Arizona's, like, solar power is turning Arizona into, like, a great manufacturing hub, and you just need one desalinization plant or two, or, you know, a few big desalinization plants in Mexico.
They are still incredibly costly and inefficient, but yeah, it's better than nothing.
Yeah, I mean, solar-powered or nuclear-powered desalination.
Yeah, if you have access electricity, then yeah.
So yeah, like, it's just the United States is
the lucky country.
Definitely going to suffer from climate change, but less than everybody else does. And the fact that we've destroyed, and that's the horrific thing, is that if it weren't for the war in Libya, a lot of Africa would be more capable of dealing with the horrific effects, and also more capable of, like, providing a united front at the United Nations and in other venues of being like, hey, guys, you're destroying us. But we've basically, with the 2011 destruction of Libya and the wave of destruction that pushed across the Sahel. I mean, it's just nonstop coups, and it's like the Cold War again.
Which brings me to something he keeps talking about, which is Russia is moving into Central Africa, but it would appear that when there was a little coup in Russia with Wagner, it seems like they have pretty much slowly dissolving away in the Central African Republic. So even they've lost their edge, and there's even talk of, like, Ukrainian mercenaries doing their best to pick them off in car. So the idea of, oh, they're moving into Africa, it's like, have you not seen how many American soldiers are there? And the odd French destroying the place.
That was always an absurdity. As I think we've covered at great length here, people got momentarily very excited about the Central African Republic because Wagner managed to briefly pacify a country of like 4 million people. But
sadly, it's something that's happened for decades, which is white countries propping up whoever's got a big load of money to kill the locals.
Yep.
Like it's been happening in the Congo for a very long time. I think it's Dutch and French tend to be. It's just, you know, it's sadly a very normal thing to happen there.
Yeah. Well, the thing was, in the first decade of the century, we were finally getting away from that. And people were talking more about pushing out French influence. And Gaddafi was funding a lot of that anti-imperial against sort of. So we killed him.
Gaddafi, friend of the show.
Yeah. Actually, you know, like he was a lunatic. He was a disaster. But in his last decade, he came in from the cold. He gave up all his weapons for mass destruction and decided to be a pain in the ass by funding international organizations and making Africa richer. And that was something.
And a more stable place.
Yeah, it was something we probably shouldn't have ended. But anyway, back to Robert Gates. So yeah, it's so he talks a lot about Xi and Putin and talking about how, they're ignoring entirely how they came to power, what has formed their approach to things, which is balls out U.S. aggression, and the fact that probably both of them would be pretty open to diplomacy if we ever tried it. You know, taken together, Xi's and Putin's convictions portend a dangerous period ahead for the United States. The problem is not merely China or Russia's military strength and aggressiveness. It is that both leaders have already made major miscalculations. And this is kind of funny, is just that, like, even this guy,
And this scare story is basically saying they're both a bit rubbish.
They're idiots, yes. And they're going to make major miscalculations. And, like, it's just like, why is this our problem? Like, why is it the U.S.'s problem? Because we've chosen to make Ukraine and Taiwan our problem. Because we've chosen this policy of massive overstretch. Now, I say that, and I know the instinct is like, you want to abandon Ukraine and Taiwan? To be clear, I'd be fine with it. But that's not saying that I want to abandon them. I'm very down to defend them and help them with their independence if it's cheap. And the thing was, up until 2014, it was really cheap in Ukraine. Until the Biden administration. Even Trump wasn't that, well, I mean, Trump and Biden administration, it was really cheap in Taiwan. In 2015, you had Xi Jinping meeting with the democratically elected president of Taiwan. Like, there was a democratically elected president of Ukraine, of a united and at peace Ukraine in 2014 until the United States funded his overthrow. Like, there's this sense that, like, they've made these major miscalculations. Like, yeah, they've made miscalculations because we wanted it. We wanted this war in Ukraine and we got it. I mean, we didn't necessarily want hundreds of thousands of people dead, but we absolutely wanted to split off Europe from Russia, and we absolutely worked really hard to use Ukraine to do that for decades, and we succeeded. And yeah, like, now, obviously, I want to keep arming Ukraine. I think we should argue for diplomacy and, you know, finally get it into the South Korea position that is inevitable. Yeah, it's just so frustrating to me that there's just no knowledge of history or no, like, talking about why. And yes, the concession that they're idiots, you know, but you have to understand that Washington must therefore change Xi's and Putin's calculus and reduce the chances of disaster. An effort that will require strategic vision and bold action. It's like, no, it wouldn't. It requires less aggression. It's simply, Ukraine is done. Like, we now have South Korea in the heart of the Soviet Union. Okay, great. Big success. Killed 200,000 people to do it. NATO is now going to have to exist for another 50 years. That's what Washington, D.C. wanted. Like, that's a huge success story from the perspective of Robert Gates. I'd argue it was entirely unnecessary, but it's what happened. It's what is done. There is still today, like, China has done miraculously little
to counter the nonstop aggression from the Trump and Biden administrations. There's been a lot of a big kerfluffle recently because China, get this, China has decided to start looking into the tax records of Foxconn. If you don't know, Foxconn is a Taiwanese company that builds most of the world's iPhones in mainland China.
But also a lot of other technology. Whatever you're listening to this on probably has some Foxconn in it.
It's a tremendously successful, it's like a linchpin of the Taiwanese economy. It's amazing to me that all these people who want war with China over Taiwan just ignore completely how much of Taiwan's prosperity is rooted into its deep, deep connections with China. So everyone's just like, oh my God, how could they do that? It's like, we have acted to destroy a Chinese technology company, Huawei. We have acted to keep anybody with a U.S. passport from working with any Chinese technology company. We have sent, discarded our decades-long policy of strategic ambiguity around Taiwan. We've started sending official U.S. figures there. We have put U.S. soldiers on Taiwan. China so far decided to do a tax investigation of the main Taiwanese company that makes the biggest all the products for the biggest American company. Like, and I think that's just an indication. Like, China hasn't done anything. Like, just this ludicrous nonsense about, like, they're violating Taiwan's airspace. So, like, no. They're violating Taiwan's, like, ADIZ. I can't remember what the acronym
is. It's not like their sovereign ground. It's kind of like as far as their radars can detect.
So, yeah, so it's essentially, if China wants to fly, because we created a U.S. colony on, you know, essentially China's Long Island, they violate that area if China wants to fly a fighter jet across, like, a solid quarter of its coastline. They violate the ADIZ. Like, and it's just this baseline ignorance of, like, how the world works, of what has happened, of what the real relationship is between China and Russia. You know, he says in the first, he's right. China does present the potential of a very serious adversary. But you can see when he's writing, he's practicing, he's like, gleeful, because it means that, like, you know, it's something that we can justify defense budgets on forever. But in order to do that, we'd have to actually start this fight with China that is completely unnecessary and is completely our own choice. And it's just so frustrating.
Paragraph 5.
Yeah. And so the United States finds itself in a uniquely treacherous position, facing aggressive adversaries with a propensity to miscalculate, so idiots, yet incapable of mustering the unity and strength necessary to dissuade them. The unity and strength necessary to dissuade him. What he's talking about is taking our $1 trillion defense budget and, what, bringing it up to $1.5 trillion? That's what he wants.
That's a good idea. I like that.
Yeah, $1.5 trillion sounds good.
And once
sounds
that like becomes the norm... I don't know, 1.7?
Why not 3?
You can't do that. You got to work up to 3.
Well, you've got to understand, Rory, in 2020, in 1 year, we spent $2 trillion on social programs, you know, because of COVID. So,
but that's, yeah, you could take that money out and move it to all the military stuff.
Yeah, well, you can do that every year because we did it 1 year for social program, and then we can do that every year for military. That's how things work in that.
What I find interesting about this whole article in general is nothing of it is like anything's going to happen to America. It's like two countries most Americans probably thought were already part of the other country they were going to invade anyway. Like, if you ask the average American, they'd be like, is Taiwan not part of China? Is Ukraine not a province of Russia? Like, I'm sure a lot just couldn't care less. And that's the big doomsday scenario. It's not like the first paragraph is, you know, this is worse than when, like, Mexico invaded or the British burnt down the White House. And it's basically, yeah, some countries you may have heard of might be invaded by their neighbors.
Yeah.
Like, it's for the average American, I can't see why they would care.
And the incredible hypocrisy of it is that, like, yeah, Ukraine is a bad thing that Russia's doing.
Oh, yeah,
in
it's
Ukraine.
Horrendous.
The United States has sponsored, armed, and funded Saudi Arabia to do the same thing to Yemen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And also, yeah, and Turkey, our NATO ally, with less direct funding and support from us, but with not none has been doing the same thing to Syria. So like it's just like do we?
They're the Russia in so many more scenarios.
So yet instead, dysfunction has made American power erratic and unreliable, practically inviting risk-prone autocrats to place dangerous bets with potentially catastrophic effects. And this is true. Like, we are erratic and unreliable. We're erratic and unreliable because we are incredibly aggressive. And he's talking about deterrence. We need to be stronger and more aggressive. And it's like, no, like, we need to just back off. And it's amazing how many problems would be solved. Like, Afghanistan, it's what, 2 years later? It's about two years after we pulled out. Afghanistan has spent the past 2 years in greater peace than it has experienced for 40 years. It's terrible what, you know, the Taliban is not letting women be educated. This is very bad.
But did America only ever control about 40% of Afghanistan anyway?
Yeah.
That means those regions have not changed at all?
Yes.
That's 60%?
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. Yeah, so it's certainly sad what's happened to Afghanistan's women, but like, their uncles and their sons are not getting obliterated anymore.
But could you not easily do a trade deal and say, could you try to treat women better and we'll 100%. You know, sell things to you?
I'm my read of how that went down, the blocking, the serial blocking of... So, they said, okay, you know, where the women can't go to college anymore, and then they can't go to high school anymore. And at every stage, they were like, they would say, okay, women are going to do this, and then like make a big deal of like not letting them do that because they were waiting for the United States to be like, hey, maybe we'll let you have your central bank money back. Maybe we'll let you, you know, like the Taliban is 100% waiting for the CIA to give them a ring and be like, hey, let's do nasty shit about China and Iran. Like, and they'd be eager to do that. They'd be eager to work with us. They'd be eager to, and in return for that, and like $100 million a year, maybe $1 billion a year, they'd be eager to let women be educated. And their country is at peace. Like, that's an opportunity that's just sitting there on the table. But we can't because we're tough and they're mean. But anyway, that's a whole other can of nastiness. But why I brought that up is that, like, for the first time in 40 years, for the past 2 years, and the U.S. media, like, just desperately trying to make it sound like the Islamic State is going to stop it from happening. And it seems like Afghanistan, the Taliban has pretty much crushed the Islamic State in Afghanistan doing that. It's amazing, you know, because why is there still Islamic State in Syria? Well, because we've kept Syria divided between three separate powers. You know, the Taliban took over, they crushed the Islamic State. Like, there's no terrorism coming out of Afghanistan anymore. And it's just so much better when we just step back. China and Taiwan could easily repair their relationship. China would wait for another half century for Taiwan to fall into its lap, is pretty gosh darn natural. But no, we want this war. We want it now. So anyway. So he says a bunch of stuff about Xi's ambitions that I don't really necessarily know to be true. Xi's call for the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation is shorthand for China becoming the dominant world power by 2049. And like, is it?
Yeah, I haven't heard that one specifically. I know they want to have five great, you know, world-leading car brands in the next 10 years. But
yeah.
I haven't heard this one about being the dominant power. Like, I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know. I haven't heard it myself outside of this article.
What he also emphasizes on a lot is that Xi desperately wants Taiwan to be part of China.
Yeah, but no one's shocked by that.
But yeah, like that's the thing. It's he consistently puts this as this crazy thing that Xi Jinping wants.
Oh yeah, the greatest threat America has ever seen.
He's so dedicated that, you know, that he wants Taiwan. How dare he want Taiwan? Wanting Taiwan has been like Chinese policy since 1949. Like,
Since it wasn't part of China, it's been a policy.
Exactly. Like it is like a fundamental basic of Chinese policy that the United States used to be very polite about. It is not China that has changed here. It is the United States that has changed here. Xi's aspiration and sense of personal destiny entail significant risk of war. it is not Xi's personal destiny. It is what China has always wanted and what the United States used to be pretty clear about not getting in the way of.
Has the editor added in points at any part? Because there's a bit where it talks about China has more warships than the United States, and then it just has brackets, although they are of poorer quality.
Yeah.
I just find that line quite adorable. I think it's like they're just not up to American standards. So yes, there's more of them, but America would eviscerate them.
Yeah, I mean, Foreign Affairs has some editorial standards.
Okay.
It is not a joke publication.
It's not a free-for-all.
It has a position. They will occasionally let they do occasionally publish people who disagree with U.S. foreign policy, but like it's usually sandwiched between four other people who are like, we're smart about this, we promise. What's amazing here is, okay, so, you know, he does point out this kind of a valuable point that Xi's sort of neo-Mao stuff, by departing from Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping's maxim of hide your strength, bide your time, Xi has provoked exactly the response Deng feared. The United States has mobilized its economic power to slow China's growth. Begun strengthening and modernizing its military. I actually did write here, are you effing kidding me? So according to Robert Gates, the United States, now spending $1 trillion on the military every year, has begun strengthening and modernizing its military.
theoretically it always is. There's always a new toy box being
This
revealed.
Is a process we have begun.
Oh, you've just begun it since the end of Cold War, or
we're just starting.
Just starting.
So this gets again. I think I don't recall if it was the beginning. I think it was last episode I mentioned it. Like the baseline that Robert Gates wants, that the vast majority of the people writing the Foreign Affairs wants, that sort of the blob, the deep state wants, is George W. Bush. That's the level of U.S. military spending and aggression that they see as normal.
Mission accomplished.
That's the level that they see as normal. They see Obama's attempts, and Obama did make real attempts, and actually there was a real attempt to limit defense spending during the Obama administration, sequestration and all that. And as Robert Gates makes clear in passages there's no way we're ever going to make it to, he sees that as an abomination. He sees that as, how dare they, how could they, have limited the Budget Control Act of 2011, put in place automatic spending cuts known as sequestration, and reduced the federal budget by $1.2 trillion over 10 years. The military, which then accounted for only about 15% of federal expenditures, was forced to absorb half the cut, $600 billion. That's over 10 years, by the way. So they required the military to cut $60 billion a year. With personal costs exempted, the bulk of the reductions had to come from maintenance operations, training, and investment accounts. Why did they have to come from maintenance operations, training, and investment accounts? Why couldn't they have come from these absurd contracts for weapons systems that are cost plus forever and take up literally half of that $1 trillion we spend every year? To be clear, back in 2011, we spent less than $1 trillion a year. It was probably around 700 or 800 billion after the Bush years. I don't quote me on those numbers.
And how much did Tunisia need to not fall into anarchy?
Oh yeah, Tunisia could have been maintained as a democracy.
4 or 5 billion, I think you said.
Oh, a billion a year.
Oof,
if we gave them a billion a year in grants, mm-hmm. not loans, because Tunisia's never been offered any. Oh no. The EU is now offering Tunisia's dictatorship over $1 billion in grants to stop migrant flows for them. But yeah, if we'd given Tunisia's democracy, the only democracy in the Arab world, $1 billion a year,
about democracy.
Yeah, then democracy could have plausibly spread from Tunisia to Algeria to Libya. Like it really could have made a better world. But anyway. So this it's interesting here just how outraged he is that the military, which was only 15% of federal expenditures at that point, was forced to absorb half that cut, $600 billion. Like 2011 was the point at which we withdrew from Iraq, a horrific and horrifically expensive failure that was eating up
tens of billions of dollars every year, hundreds of billions of dollars every year. That's the thing. Like after the Cold War, like we built up this immense military establishment that Robert Gates grew up in to fight the Soviet Union. That we won. It was over. And in the 1990s, there was real cutback. And to be clear, in the 1980s, Reagan, as part of the strategy for defeating the Soviet Union, dramatically inflated our already high defense budget. So that's the point, this like Reagan massive spending on defense. In the 1990s, because we won the Cold War, we actually did see serious defense cuts, and that made sense. After 9/11, boom. Like I should have got I don't know if we were right back to Reagan in the 80s, but we were pretty close, maybe even significantly higher. And for complete failures in Iraq and Afghanistan. In 2011, Gates is outraged that after these complete failures in Iraq and Afghanistan that were obscenely expensive, so much more expensive than anything that Obama or Trump or Biden did, because these were massive contributions of U.S. troops on the ground, just so much more complicated and expensive. And he's outraged that in 2011, after losing that war in Iraq and ending that war in Iraq, that the U.S. Congress had the temerity to lower things down a little bit. That's pretty much over. That's done with. Trump did away with the sequestration entirely. That's not something that Gates acknowledges. The consequence, as of September 2003, Congress is headed towards making the same mistake again. I'm not sure what he's talking about. Congress is not headed towards making that same mistake again. They should be. They absolutely should be cutting defense budget because it does done nothing for us, makes the world more dangerous. I think it's worth talking about something that the United States power has brought about decades of peace. The truth is that U.S. power since the end of World War II has been essential in providing a platform of peace and security for much of the world. It's been tremendously important for Europe. It's been tremendously important for Asia. It has been a lot more of a mixed bag for Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East, where in the Middle East it's been, I would argue, flatly horrific for 70, 80 years. But he's not wrong. It's actually really important that the United States maintain itself as the largest military power, works for stability. What he's not pointing out, what is like, I think, at the heart of a very real dysfunctional superpower that we are today, to use the title of his article, and is sort of at the heart of the monstrous fraud of the military-industrial complex, is that, yes, we are essential. U.S. military power is essential to maintaining peace, but the main threat to that peace that is maintained by U.S. military power is U.S. military power. And that's something that is simply not present or acknowledged in this article at any point. The epic contest between the United States and its allies on one side and China, Russia, and their fellow travelers on the other is well underway. That's something worth highlighting.
Fellow travelers? That sounds like something out of Lord of the Rings. That's a strange terminology.
Oh, no, it's a classic Cold War terminology. Okay. Robert Gates is showing his age there. The fellow travelers were communists and their fellow travelers, folks who, it's sort of a very right-wing thing to say about, oh, well, you know, the liberals are really just the fellow travelers and the commies or whatever.
Okay, so people that support them outside of their countries, essentially.
Yeah, but the thing is, we do have an epic contest going on right now, Rory.
Mm-hmm.
It's not between the United States and its allies on one side. It is the United States versus the United States. The world has been and continues to be more and more run by the United States. And the problems in the world, almost all of them, or at least the ones that we hear about in the news in the United States, are created by the United States. So like the Chinese and the Russians and their fellow travelers are not this axis of people involved in an epic contest against the United States. They're just bystanders in the process of getting steamrolled over.
What do you think goes through the process of making them, you know, out in the cold? Why are they chosen to be, you know, the enemy when lots of other powers could be that are, you know, included in, like Saudi Arabia?
They're the enemy because they think they have sovereignty.
Oh.
because they think they're independent and they don't let go of that. I think the most interesting example of that would be India. So India is a sovereign country, emphatically a sovereign country, was definitely, was to some level, never a violent, rarely a violent, but to some level an antagonist of the United States during the Cold War, is still a mostly sovereign country and putting together more pieces of being a sovereign country. And it is interesting that the United States has not yet painted a target on India's back, but that's because they're useful against China. I do think probably if India gets much more powerful and China stumbles as hard as many believe is possible, it's entirely possible by the 2040s. I assume Robert Gates will be dead, but...
You control F, China, delete that, and then put in India?
Yeah. I mean, Robert Gates, you know, by the 2040s or maybe the 2050s, actually, you know, I wish Robert Gates a very long life, and they're doing, I mean, look at Henry Kissinger.
Yeah.
You know, he's still around. So Robert Gates could just be at the beginning of his pundit career. In the 2050s, he could be writing something like this. Control F, taking out China and putting in India. Saudi Arabia, it's not human rights violations. Who cares? The United States clearly doesn't care. I think he says here, we have to focus, the United States must always advocate for democracy and human rights everywhere. But that commitment must not blind Washington to the reality that U.S. national interests sometimes require it to work with repressive, unrepresentative governments. And that's clearly Saudi Arabia. I mean, that actually is maybe a sentence that a foreign affairs writer put in there to reference Saudi Arabia. I mean, Vietnam, I guess, would also fall under that rubric. And sadly, India, a very solid democracy for years, is falling more into that as well. It is interesting. He sort of talks about public diplomacy. This is later on in the article. Which I think is actually very true. Public diplomacy is essential to promoting U.S. interests. But Washington has let this important instrument of power wither since the end of the Cold War. Meanwhile, China is spending billions of dollars around the world to advance its narrative. Russia, okay, so basically, you know, China's got whatever the Chinese equivalent is, and Russia's got Russia Today, and the United States doesn't have public diplomacy is... Yeah.
Okay. How many people learn English by watching American shows?
Yeah. It's laughable. We have independent journalistic institutions in the United States that very, very, very occasionally, almost none of the television outlets, but the print journalist institution do occasionally work to hold the U.S. government to account. More and more occasionally. But fundamentally, like, we have CNN, okay? Like, and it does not, like, do very, you know, hard-hitting anti-U.S. journalism. That is anti-U.S. government journalism. Like, fundamentally, like, we have incredibly well-developed institutions of propaganda and public diplomacy. I would agree, actually, that the U.S. government... Well, actually, the U.S. government has its own actual... Voice of America, Radio Free Europe. These are journalistic institutions that still exist. I would argue that perhaps, you know, the U.S. government could do more to put out, you know, put its messages out through those institutions or put more money behind those institutions. But this idea that somehow the U.S. message isn't getting out is frankly nonsense. And CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, these are nominally partisan, you know, outlets that hate each other, are all spend 90% of their time pushing Robert Gates's line. You know, every single one of those institutions would have Robert Gates on
for an hour to talk about whatever he wants to talk about.
Well, that's what I was so surprised by. They talk about him like he's almost like royalty. It's like, oh my God, he's on the show and he's given us his, you know, precious wisdom. You know, it just felt like, no, why? But they don't seem to interview him. They just sort of go, reminds me, if you ever look at footage of like old English prime ministers being interviewed in like the 60s, they just sort of go, oh, you don't want to be asked that question? Okay, we'll move on to the next. It's so prim and proper and polite, and oh, thank you very much for answering.
Well, I mean, Robert Gates is a remnant from a more serious age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was one of the guys who, like, you know, fought and won the Cold War. I mean, I would argue we sort of won the Cold War in the 1950s, and it was mostly U.S. mistakes that kept it going after that. But no, I mean, he's like, the Bush administration, like, and elements of the Reagan administration successfully wound down the Cold War without annihilating the human race. That's a real success.
It's quite an achievement.
That's a very, very real achievement. And I think that Robert Gates is due some deference and respect for that. Unfortunately, the absolute just rot that he's been spewing, we've now dedicated two full hours to, and I think, frankly, haven't spent enough attention on the article.
Well, at least Foreign Affairs won't send us any nasty letters saying we're giving away their work for free.
That's true. We've read a few sentences here. But it is sort of tremendously disappointing, because I'll confess, Robert Gates is a guy that I have some, as I think has come through, that I have some vestigial respect for. I mean, he was in the room with U.S. presidents and U.S. policymakers who actually knew a little bit about the world. And the fact that he's, I don't know what board memberships he has, but the fact that he's just pushing this tripe is disappointing. Disappointing, to say the least. She and Putin, cocooned by yes men, have already made serious errors that have cost their countries dearly. In the long run, they have damaged their countries. For the foreseeable future, however, they remain a danger that the United States must deal with. Even for the foreseeable future, Jesus, like, I mean, is he like...
But it's also the fact he's basically saying, yeah, they're both kind of rubbish,
yeah,
but we need to worry about them.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of extraordinary.
I guess he's trying to portray it that, oh, we can beat them if only we had $3 trillion a year.
Yeah. For the foreseeable future, I mean, well, yeah, so I guess until we nuke them, I suppose, they remain a danger that the United States must deal with. Even in the best of worlds, one in which the U.S. government had a supportive public, energized leaders, and a coherent strategy of just fire-hosing trillions of dollars, trillions of dollars every year towards the Pentagon. He advocates here cutting Social Security and Medicare to support that. I don't think we emphasize that enough. So even in this magic world of a trillion, everybody... turning over our whole GDP to make missiles, these adversaries would pose a formidable challenge. But the domestic scene today is far from orderly. The American public has turned inward. Congress has descended into bickering, incivility, and brinkmanship. And successive presidents have either disavowed or done a poor job explaining America's global role. To contend with such powerful, risk-prone adversaries, the United States needs to up its game in every dimension, but especially the weapons-buying dimension. Actually, why not? How about no other dimension other than buying weapons? Only then can it hope to deter Xi and Putin from making more bad bets. The peril is real. I would argue the peril is real. The peril is real, but the peril is more Robert Gates than it is Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin.
I've had a horrible conspiracy that America deliberately keeps a lot of things in for the average American a bit rubbish to encourage them to join the army. Because if you're a bit intelligent but can't afford to, you know, go to college, you can get it paid for if you join the military.
That would be pretty sweeping bit of self-sabotage, and I don't think that's...
You don't think they're that bad?
I don't think they're that bad, no.
Okay.
But I absolutely know that people were like, oh, I know that the military recruitment is hurting, and that's one... Certainly part of the list of complaints of...
So if you cut, spending for civilians and more for the military, it's it helps both?
Definitely makes it easier to recruit people.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't think anybody... I don't have a dark enough vision of the people in charge that anybody's doing that intentionally, but...
It's just coincidentally they're making things better for the American military to recruit.
Yeah, and I think that's a good place to end because it's of fundamental importance. We've gotten to the point after 20 years with no discernible threat, no threat to the United States. We've gotten to the point where we are paying $1 trillion for the military every year, and the most respected and influential guy in U.S. foreign policy is saying, $1 trillion? How about three? And that's what the smart people are saying. That's what Harvard's Kennedy School of Government is saying. That's what the most distinguished and wisest people coming in to comment on CNN and Fox News are going to say. And it's insane.
It must be horrible, though, if you are, you know, highly intelligent going through all these top universities and then realizing, oh, I just say what they want to hear.
Yeah.
I don't need to do all this work.
I have friends who have been successful in Washington, D.C., and it's got a little sad because I remember them in their sort of 20s when they were very critical and very, you know, punk rock. And I mean, the George W. Bush years in Washington, D.C. is very easy time to be like, oh God, and it's fascinating that they're all the ones who are successful in Washington, D.C. are kowtowing to people like Elliot Abrams and even Dick Cheney and certainly Robert Gates and the people that they were so angry at when they were younger and more principled and had a clearer vision of the world.
So if you want to be successful, tell power what it wants to hear.
Bingo.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.